Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, store news, and whatever games, movies, and TV is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. Welcome to Roguecast number 204, the Nick's birthday edition.
Yeah,
it's true.
Happy birthday, Nick.
Happy birthday, Randy's birthday edition as well.
No, that's next week.
Oh, that is next
Whatever.
Week.
I'm happy about Nick's birthday, but not Randy's.
I'm also not happy about my birthday.
Your birthday is all stinko.
Yeah. I'm getting old. I don't like that.
I'm looking for my birthday because I'm going to go see a movie.
Yeah. But, so as we record this, we're recording it a day before Nick's birthday. But when you hear it is Nick's birthday.
It's true.
And so next week...
Send him out a psychic happy birthday.
Next week we'll record it on my birthday. But when
that's right.
Hear it, it'll be a day past my birthday. It'll be a day too late for those psychic happy birthdays.
What if it's a time-traveling psychic happy birthday?
Those are always welcome.
Also, keep in mind that mine is on September 26th, if you want to go ahead and start preparing your birthday wishes.
But if they prepare it now, and then they send it in September, you're going to get, like, Scanner's Explodo from those.
I was going to say, it's going to be so powerful, it's going to have had so much time to build.
You but what a way to go.
You don't want to spend too much time building up a psychic happy birthday.
It's your birthday, it's your death day. That's what happens.
Happy death day, Dave.
It was a fun movie. And my head exploded.
Alright, so quick store news. D&D Adventurers League, just a reminder, we do Tuesdays and Thursdays. Thursdays, we have four DMs. Tuesdays, we, as of this week, have two DMs.
Yep.
So call in the morning, get a spot at the table. We actually have spots on Tuesdays now, and I believe we're starting to get a little extra spots on Thursday. We finally got to the point where it's not so, you have to call right at 10 a.m. if you want a spot.
You've now jinxed it. Now this week it will just be just crazy.
But if you're like suddenly like, man, I need to go see what this D&D is about, or I just haven't played it in a while, and I kind of just want to get in on some orc killing action.
Yeah.
And like, give us a call.
Yeah, indeed. Action Comics number 1000 Midnight Release is next Tuesday, April 17th. Yes,
sir.
Indeed. So we're going to close at 9:30 on Tuesday. We will we'll close at 9 on Tuesday. We will reopen about 10:30. We're going to do DC deck building game and probably some other like Superman animated series on the TV and some other DC stuff.
I want to throw out random Superman related trivia at people and see what they can do.
Dave will be spouting random Superman questions at you, and if you get them wrong, he will yell at you like the angry Nazi soup guy from Seinfeld.
Yep. Actually, I'm gonna yell at them like Gilbert Gottfried as Mr. Mixer's Piddalick from the 90s Superman.
Fair.
Gotta kill Superman.
So yeah, come out for that. Come out for being yelled at, but like Gilbert Gottfried. And then also come out to buy Action Comics, which, we will have to on sale that night. We're holding to one per person, just so people know. Just
it's kind of first come, first served at this point,
it
right?
It is first come, first served. It is going to be a crazy night.
Yes. I'm looking forward to seeing just what they're doing with the character. I guess I probably won't be able to read it until, after hours.
There's a four-page preview floating out on the internet at the moment. It was interesting.
Is it from Bendis's part?
Yeah, it's from the Action Comics 1000.
Randy, or Nick, when you say interesting, I can tell there's quote marks around it.
There's that. I mean, it's Bendis.
Also of note, we will have the rest of DC Comics on sale that night, too.
Yes.
But then we can't sell anything else for the next day, so you have to come in 2 days that week.
Right. But still, that's pretty cool. You can get your DC on, and most importantly, see what crazy stuff is going down with Superman.
And then that Sunday, April 22nd, is our Magic the Gathering Dominaria pre-release. You can come out. And also that weekend, if you've pre-ordered, you can pick up a booster box of Dominaria. It's the first time I'm ever doing that. So you can pre-order now. You can come in anytime that Saturday or Sunday, pick up a booster box of Dominaria, and get an early look at the set.
Yeah, I was going to ask, they don't have to pre-order it necessarily. They could come in on that day as long as we've got it, right?
They're supposed to pre-order it.
Okay.
But we probably won't be super hardcore about that.
Right. And I do know we already have, I'm going to say, at least four or five pre-orders, so they're accruing.
Yep. Saturday, April 28th is International Tabletop Day. We've got a variety of games running. You can go on the website and see our list. We have a few late things coming in. We may be doing a Munchkin CCG. We're just waiting to hear on that, some other stuff. So keep up with that. That'll update as we get closer. And then, of course, that next Saturday, May 5th, is Free Comic Book Day. It is approaching, fellas.
There are so many things that are occurring.
Yeah, we're at that point. I think there's something every weekend in June, too. So, yeah.
Did you say, is Tabletop Day before that?
The week before.
Oh, my God.
Tabletop Day 1 week, Free Comic Book Day the next week. A couple weeks off, then free RPG day.
When am I ever going to have free Saturdays again?
Then all just awesomeness. You're not. all right, so so a bunch of stuff going on in the store. Basically, from now until, I guess, about August, you should probably just come into the store every weekend.
Yes.
And even if nothing's going on, just play some board games. our board game library has like 150 games in it.
Yeah, we just added it. We added a whole bunch.
We added Arkham Horror, the new LCG. We added Mansions of Madness. We added
Legend of the Five Rings.
People can come get their Lovecraft on. They can get their Samurai on.
We added Dice Forge, which is one of my favorite.
They can get their dice forging on.
We've got Dice Throne in there, which is a great game. So yeah,
more
come
dice.
come out, play the board game library. You can do that on weekends. You can come out on weeknights as long as it's not a gaming night.
Yep.
So yeah, all right. Moving on to other news. We got a bunch of trailers. Starting with How to Talk to Girls at Parties.
Right. Neil Gaiman, based on a book.
Based on Neil Gaiman, or is it a graphic novel? Or is it a book turned into a graphic novel?
Anybody here read it?
No. I think it's right. It's one of the other.
Something Neil Gaiman wrote.
Yep.
They turned into a movie.
They've also turned into a graphic novel, or possibly they turned into a graphic novel and then turned into a movie.
You never know.
Or maybe it started as a movie, became a graphic novel, became a novel, but it's going backwards in time.
I believe it started as a graphic novel, is being adapted into a movie, and now a new graphic novel come out adapting the movie.
And then a play.
Yes.
Then a radio play.
Mm-hmm. And an old Zork-style text adventure.
Yes.
The trailer looks pretty good.
I don't know if this is weird.
Right, it's set in, looks like 70s.
1971 London. It's in the punk. Three sort of teenage guys get into punk. They wind up at a party full of alien girls.
Yep.
One of the girls.
The girls look normal, but act weird.
Yeah,
they're not like aliens, like with antennas or weird looking. Yep. But they're just weird acting.
Weird appendages coming out of their backs.
There's crazy morphing aliens.
Yeah,
it looks like Earth Girls Were Easy.
Yeah, kind of
a little bit of that,
but with punk.
Right, so it looks like it's got some weirdness. It's got some heart.
It's the director, the writer director who did Hedwig and the Angry Inch, which I've never seen, but I have friends who adore that movie.
I also, even though I watched this the other day, and in my mind I equated it somewhat with Scott Pilgrim, and it doesn't have the same kind of larger-than-life qualities of that, but I suspect that some of the same people who like that might like this.
I think you're right. I'm not, super into it based on this, but I'm curious.
Because you hate the British.
It has Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
Has Ruth Wilson.
And honestly, if you are looking to the 70s punk style of it, which a lot of these dudes, I'm going to say, there's Sid Vicious, and there's actually the lead dude looked all Billy Idol-ish, which is actually really, he's like an 80s guy, but it looked like they were going to have some fun with the visuals and the era.
Yeah, it looks potentially fun. Then there was The Meg.
Man. Finally, another giant shark movie that's not from sci-fi.
I watched this morning, and it starts off, and I thought it was going to be this future-y sci-fi like colony underwater, because it looks like this cool underwater station.
Yeah,
and then it's like a Miami Beach thing.
Right. Well, I couldn't tell how much was going to be bouncing around between there.
Well, it's Jason Statham versus a megalodon.
Right, so
It's
a prehistoric shark. It does not have me at that. No. I will say
this looks terrible.
This looks fun.
And there we have it.
Does not mean it can't be both of those things.
True.
Just this morning, we brought up Deep Blue Sea. Yeah. I have not seen Deep Blue Sea.
Neither.
I'm aware of a scene where a shark pops up and kills
Samuel Jackson
randomly in the middle of it or near the end of it
in the middle of his speech.
And I know it's beloved for that, but I've seen other bits and pieces of it, and it didn't look so good to me.
Yeah, it'd be
How dare you besmirch LL Cool J and The Punisher?
The only time I like LL Cool J is when he's in the opening to the Charlie's Angels movie. It's a deep cut, y'all.
I think if you're the type of person who loves Deep Blue Sea, you'll like the movie.
For you. I will say the special effects looked pretty good on it.
Sure.
For a shark that is... by the way, if I'm not mistaken, an actual megalodon is not as big as movie megalodon.
No.
Actual megalodon, I think, is probably 40 feet long or something here. But here it looks like he's 100 feet long. Or it's like he's crazy giant.
It's a big shark.
I'm in favor of it. I like big sharks.
And you cannot lie?
I cannot lie.
when a shark walks in with an itty-bitty fin.
I'm just saying, Jason Statham... He makes some bad movies, but he makes fun ones, too. So.
He makes mostly bad movies.
Well, there's the Fast and Furious movies.
Yeah, you could argue that.
That doesn't negate what Randy said.
Transporter?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Sure.
I feel like we're in the same ballpark here.
Yeah.
Anyway, I have no interest, but it does look dumb and fun.
Right. Yeah. Same here. I could see it being a rental for me, or if I was convinced, I could see it at the theater if it was getting kind of fun buzz.
Yep. All right. The first Purge trailer was here. This is the fourth Purge movie.
Right.
Goes back to the early days of the Purge. And I think for me, it was all too familiar. Like, I love the Purge movies. I'll probably see this one when it comes to HBO or whatever, too. But I needed... If they were going to do the first Purge, I really was going to hope it was, like, not as much about the Purge itself, but about sort of all the machinations leading up to it and more of a suspense thriller.
I feel like they can never quite get away from their baseline thing of, like, people in very scary masks, which, by the way, the Purge has all the scariest mask people.
Yes, it's true.
And can I just quick say, because I just watched Purge Election Night the other day, and, I enjoyed it. Like, it did seem like slightly diminishing returns at that point.
Sure.
But the two, like, kind of, like, I'm going to say... upper class girls who are like stealing from the party girls.
The
ending that they get is so awesome.
Yeah.
It's my favorite scene in the whole movie.
Also, their costumes are terrifying.
Yes, yeah, they're super scary. And I have to say, the actresses pulled off scary entitlement.
Yeah.
And, like, it's always believed, there's a certain degree of believability to every Purge movie, as crazy as the idea is. And the off chance you don't know what it is, it's a thing where the government legalizes for one night any crimes.
Yeah.
The idea is, like, it'll be cathartic for the nation, and you can even kill people and stuff like that, so people hole up in their homes. But as we learn over the course of the movies, it's very much a... the rich use this to kind of weed out the poor.
It's class warfare.
And it's literal class warfare.
Well, when it first came out, I think you and I, especially Nick, Dave, and Nick, you might have been on the board this too, we were all thinking, like, this looks like another one of these home invasion horror movies.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that is what was clearly happening in the trailer, is people with scary masks, which we've seen in many home invasion movies, were breaking into a house, and it was on a night that murder was legal.
But then you guys both saw it and told me it was good, and I wound up watching it, and I really liked it, and it's because it's... the aspects of it, the sort of socio-political aspects of it, are really interesting.
Yeah. It always feels very believable when they have, like, even in the first one, somebody's, like, on their way home from work, and they're like, oh, you know, time to get home, 7 o'clock, this is, you know, the Purge starts, and, oh, certain neighbors are throwing Purge parties where they all get together and hang out throughout the night,
and
the wealthy people have, like, you know, armor plating in their house so that, you know, they're basically safe, and they could, people who can afford to be safe are safe.
Yeah.
Well, they've definitely gotten bigger and bigger with each movie. I mean, the first one was sort of focused on one home,
right,
and one home invasion.
Then it became more city-based as people were trapped out on the streets during one of the nights, and you had
third one was big, kind of megalomaniacal, the guys behind the
There was a politician.
Fathers.
Right, there was a politician opposing it who was very much a Wendy Davis visual type, and probably politically, and they were clearly going to use the night as a cover to assassinate her.
Yeah.
These have all felt... I will say this. Even if there's a little bit of diminishing returns on watching people being terrorized in the streets by masked people, they all feel real, and the Purge is definitely going to happen sometime during either his first or second
So definitely, everybody make sure and go see these, as they're going to be a good prep for when the Purge happens.
Yes. I believe there are probably some people waiting for that, the same way they're waiting for zombies, only this one actually can happen.
Yes, exactly.
So... Purge, what is it called? The first Purge?
The first Purge.
Does it look like it will deal with the notion of, like, how this was sold to people, which sounded interesting to me, you know, and machinations. Again, there's always some sort of skeevy government machinations to make sure that people buy into it.
Yeah.
And so there's clearly intimated in there that it's not just crazy mass people out there out to kill their boss or whoever, but that there's, like, using it to cover up, like, sort of a hit squad who are probably going to... I'm not quite sure what they think it will be. Do they just want more participation?
But it looks like they're also targeting, like, maybe a Black Lives Matter type group.
Well, it seems like this is about, like, a brainchild for Marissa Tomei's character.
Yeah.
And then she finds out that the government is using it to basically get rid of the disenfranchised and the homeless and the people who are less than.
Well, Randy, you mentioned, like, if they were to go after, like, Black Lives Matter leadership or something, analog to it, that would make a lot of sense.
Yep.
Something else that I've liked about these movies is broadly they've had, I think the first one was pretty white, but they've had more minority participation in every single one of them. And it looks like there's like lead African American characters in this one.
Yeah.
I like these movies. I like what they say politically. I like they're spooky and actiony and stuff like, and suspenseful.
Are they still planning on doing the TV series? I know sci-fi was
still, as far as I know, in the works. So yeah.
That again seems like a stretch, but they could kind of find ways to talk about some of the things we've mentioned here, like that, where you could expand on it. for a TV show, and it might end up working better than I would think. But anyway, yeah, I think I'm where you are, Randy, where I would probably, like, catch it, not necessarily in theaters, but I'll probably want to see it at some point. I was late to the party on Purge Election Year, and I ended up liking it.
Yeah.
Nick, what about you? You going to catch it in the theater?
Probably.
I think.
I've liked all the Purge movies.
Yeah.
Nick is the person they invented a movie pass for, although he still didn't have one.
Yeah, I still don't have one.
You know what you need to do, Nick, with your crafting skills? You need to make your own scary-ass Purge mask that has to be your thing. It's got to be unique. And I'm going to suggest, by the way, look at those early Bill Sienkiewicz Demon Bear storylines with this giant socketed eye. You know what I'm talking about, Randy?
It's a good idea. You probably should make a Purge mask because it's definitely good.
Yeah. I just meant for the premiere, but also for the actual Purge.
Yeah. All right. Final trailer. The new Solo trailer is out, the full trailer.
Oh, right.
I was a little underwhelmed by this one, to be honest.
Me too,
I thought it was okay.
I'm already sold on the Solo movie. I'm going to see it, although possibly not opening weekend just because it's a weekend I've got other stuff going. But I like the idea of Donald Glover's young Lando. Alden Rick, although everybody is like bashing this guy, looks fine.
Yeah, it looks solid.
It's a heist movie in the Star Wars universe, which I want to see. But someone mentioned the other day, I remember, was that said, when are we going to admit that we basically gave Alden Ehrenreich an impossible job? Like, be Harrison Ford at his peak.
Right.
No one can do that job.
Right. And the interesting thing is, like, I think he also has to somewhat portray, he has to have a bit of an arc in this. So he's probably going to end up start, like, I mean, a version of what Han Solo has, but he can't become completely altruistic by the end of it.
Yeah.
Because Han Solo doesn't have to have that happen until he meets up with the rebels and all that stuff and falls for a princess. So he's got to be on his way there, but he can't be there.
But they've definitely, the trailer hits on the iconic stuff. His gun, the Falcon, Lando,
Chewie.
A friend of mine on Facebook said something I thought was kind of interesting. For the first few, maybe the first 20, 30 seconds of it, where they just do his visuals, but before you see Woody Harrelson and you start kind of getting a little bit of plot, that it's a Western vibe.
Yeah.
There's like a bunch of guys standing out in a desert and they look like, you know, bandits in a movie, but they got cool Star Wars gear.
Yeah.
And, I think you see Solo reaching for the gun and, you know, it's very much a Western drawdown kind of thing. And then the guy said, I kind of lost interest in the second half. He's like, I felt like it veered away from the Western vibe of that first, you know, third of it or whatever. And then somebody said, pointed out, it's like, well, they do rob a train, apparently, in it. And the more I think about that notion, the more I like of it as space Western. Star Wars has always had that. The original cantina scene was straight up Western.
Yeah.
Right, so especially down to the somebody gets shot and then the piano player starts playing again, like, that's just Tuesday for us.
Yeah.
They full on do
it. I like all the players involved. I like the Mother of Dragons. I like Woody Harrelson.
Yep.
These are all good people, so I won't be like my
Woody
wife.
Woody Harrelson's the weirdest one to me because he can't help but pop somewhat as Woody Harrelson.
Oh, but he's been in so many other things at this point because he was also the Hunger Games guy.
Yeah.
He was the Hunger Games guy.
He popped a little bit weirdly for me in that, too. Yeah. But he was good in it. What were you saying, Nick, your wife?
Kaylee basically saw the preview and was like, is this a joke? So she was underwhelmed by the preview.
I have actually seen a few people have that sort of reaction, which is funny to me because I'm like, you know, they're sort of like, I don't know if they just feel like it looks bad or if it's just sort of like, really, we're going to get young Han Solo's story? And I'm like, prequely sort of concepts like that make sense to me. Like, I was always expecting that they would maybe do this. Even like, probably like 10 or 15 years ago or 15 or 20 years ago, we were like dreaming like, oh, what if they showed how he met Chewie and their early adventures and the Kessel Run and all that?
Yeah.
And, well, they're going to do it. And it's just a question of whether Ron Howard and those his pals can pull it off.
I feel like at base...
Ron Howard narration, they could not.
They could not. By the way, I love that Ron Howard narration has become a meme.
Oh, man. Yeah.
That's
so good.
But that would be amazing if Ron Howard narrated the whole thing from Arrested Development.
At the very least, especially if it like proves itself, like if it's doing well.
Can he just
He did like at least do a new trailer for it, or
My God. Someone needs to edit together the trailer with Arrested Development footage.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
There's enough there.
Oh, man. That'd be amazing. Come on, Internet. You know you want to.
It's probably already out there, Randy.
It's probably already out there. All right, so a little bit of TV casting. Carl Urban is going to be Billy Butcher, the lead in The Boys on Amazon.
Well, so much for that Dread series that we wanted.
I don't know.
Is Carl Urban British?
Maybe.
No.
I don't know.
I don't think so.
He might be.
I don't really know.
Anyway, we don't know. But I'm going to say no, he's not.
I'm going to check.
And also, they did not cast...
Is it going to be a British-ish show?
They did cast Wee Huey, and it is not, in fact...
Simon Pegg.
What's his name? Simon Pegg.
He's, to be fair, he's aged out of the role.
Yeah.
He is, Wee Huey, as in the comic, looked more like Simon Pegg when he was in space.
Yeah. He's not British. He's New Zealand.
Oh, yeah, really?
He's a
false Brit.
He's still got an accent. It's fine.
Yeah.
At any rate, I don't think any of the three of us are fans of The Boys.
No.
Not really.
But it's Garth Ennis at his Garth Ennis.
Yep.
Ennis. It takes like the preacher's level of sort of, I'm going to say, depravity.
Yeah.
And throws it onto his own critique of superheroes, but very much by extension, America. And I can get behind that, but... You know, at a certain point, Garth Ennis is just a little too schoolboyish sometimes.
My only hope is that somebody comes along from Hollywood. I forget who's actually producing this or
making
it.
It's the same guy who did Preacher. It's Seth Rose, Brogan, and all this kind of thing.
I idolize Garth Ennis to the point where
I don't
kind
love
of...
that, but they also, I was reminded, did Future Man.
Yeah. But what I was going to say is that hopefully they can take a kernel of what The Boys was and not go too far and actually make something out of it.
I would guess they're going to go further.
I know, probably so.
Well, they may be able to, like, it sort of felt to me like outside of the two leads that they're, you know, he kind of wrote character sketches, but not, like, deeper characters.
Yeah.
And Ennis is sort of at his best when his characters have some real connections and depth to them. I think from just kind of when I would flip through it and look for depravities early on, I think some of the other characters did get a little bit fleshed out. So they may do a little bit of work with that.
I mean, it went on 60 issues. I mean, I feel like the Garth Ennis doesn't not do that. So
we have friends who love this book.
Who are they making? What network? Or
Amazon.
I mean, is it Amazon? Okay,
so they can go as far as off the reservation as
they
want.
I just hope there's one certain scene that we know is in the show.
Yep. I know the particular movie viewing you're speaking of, and we'll see just what Amazon's limits are that day.
Other TV news, which I'm more excited about, is Star Trek has cast their Captain Pike.
Oh, yeah.
So for those who saw Discovery, spoilers for the end of season one, they run into the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And Captain Pike is in charge.
Yep. So this is like roughly 10 years before Kirk's time. So that does mean Spock is his first officer.
Yep,
if you saw the lost first episode of Star Trek, which they would later use in the episode. I suddenly can't say the name of it. The Cage was the original one.
I was going to say, if you don't get it, we're not going to.
But I think it's called like the Menagerie or something like that.
I think that's right.
Your co-host, Stephen Fothery, is beating you over the head.
He's not listening to this. He knows I have a bad memory anyway. Yeah, this was the guy who was originally cast in the role. They ended up going with Shatner instead, and that was a wise choice. But he had a lot of those kind of Shatner-esque qualities. At least he was kind of like a steely leading man of that 60s style where he could be a little sensitive, but was still kind of a man's man.
Yeah. Well, they cast Anson Mount. Sort of makes sense. He was the guy that cast as Black Bolt, and it wasn't his fault.
But I think more importantly, he was one of the leads in
Hot Wheels.
Right.
Yeah.
My co-host Fothery, Steve Fothery, who does the Text Trek podcast with me on all things Star Trek, but with a focus on Discovery. I guess he said he'd watched the first season of that, and he was some pretty impressive acting from the dude.
Yeah, he's really good. He's actually really good.
So yeah, so and visually he looks like Pike. He actually has a little bit of that sort of handsome, steely resolve. I'm going to say that Pike has. He's a little bit. Kirk was a little bit more kind of, in some ways, down to earth, a little bit more relaxed in his way, and Pike seemed slightly more intense.
I liked Bruce Greenwood from the movie.
He was great. He was great.
But it was a different version of Pike.
That was kind of more of an overhaul, and this is at least theoretically is meant to go and will fill in, and you know, this is the same Pike that, you know, that we saw in the Star Trek original series.
Yeah.
By the way, jump back just a bit. I did forget one key bit about the Boys.
Yeah.
Eric Kripke from Supernatural and Timeless.
Oh.
He is creator and showrunner on it.
Well,
so
that's notable.
Because
he's a good showrunner, and I love Supernatural. So.
All right, one last bit of TV news. AMC has picked up Nos4A2, the
Joe Hill
novel turned into a comic, now turned into a TV show.
Yeah. Isn't it
turned
back
into a podcast? And,
the Nosferatu of the title, isn't that like a license plate with the sort of leet spelling
style? Yes, it is.
Nick, what is this book about?
I don't know. I didn't read it.
Okay, well,
but Nick, you know all things about Joe Hill. Extrapolate. Guess.
I'm going to guess about a vampire.
Do we think he drives a car and runs people over and then drinks their blood?
Possibly.
I think he probably, like...
And foolishly got a vanity license plate, which makes it easy for the vampire hunters to slay him, but he can't change it.
Yeah.
He's so vain.
He's so vain. It's about a vain vampire.
I like it. The book writes itself.
Really, technically, all vampire stories are about vain vampires.
Yeah.
It's a double meaning.
Man.
It had a double meaning.
All
right.
So,
high five to myself.
No one... Not even high five yourself. Don't... No.
I'm gonna quick throw out a bit of TV news that we didn't put in here, but
I have a premise.
Okay, go for it.
Nosferatu introduces Vic McQueen, a young working class artist who discovers she has a supernatural ability to track the seemingly immortal Charlie Manx. Manx feeds off the souls of children, then deposits the remains of them into Christmasland, a twisted Christmas village of Manx's imagination, where every day is Christmas Day and unhappiness is against the law. Vic must strive to defeat Manx and rescue his victims without losing her mind or falling victim to him herself. None of that features a vampire who runs people over.
Did that have a vampire anywhere in it?
No vampires.
Okay, it's more like
something immortal.
He feeds off the souls of children, sort of immortal vampire.
That was kind of like, yeah, right, and I see probably where the name came from. It makes sense. I don't expect Joe Hill to be a guy who adheres to kind of traditional tropes.
Yeah.
And actually, weirdly, it sounds a little bit like the Krampus thing in the way people were, like, trapped in, like, the little Krampus ornament things.
David, what's the TV news?
So a podcast I've talked about before, Alice Isn't Dead. Mm-hmm. It was sort of the first spinoff from the Welcome to Night Vale people. They've done other podcasts since, but this is the other one that I really like, and it's kind of an eerier road trip sort of story about a woman whose wife disappears and under somewhat mysterious circumstances, and she ends up sort of taking this a job as a trucker of all things. It's slightly surreal. And crisscrossing America trying to find her and uncovering this weird, sinister, supernatural kind of conspiracy going on, and ending up taking a role in it. And I really, really liked it. I just listened to the second season, which actually wrapped. They're about to start the third, I think, and I just happened to catch it late in the game, and I'm still very much on board the series. Anyway, the showrunner, it seems, is going to be the showrunner, I guess, of, like, Mr. Robot.
Yep.
And I have not seen Mr. Robot, but by all accounts from friends, it's very good. Right?
I really like the first two seasons.
I'm going to be deeply disappointed if they don't cast the woman who...
The voice actress?
Who's actually an actress as well. She was on Fringe for the entire series.
They're not doing Alice Isn't Dead TV show, just the Alice Isn't Dead showrunner is taking over Mr. Robot. Right?
No. They're making Alice Isn't Dead TV show, adapting the podcast.
Okay.
And the guy from, Mr. Robot will be showrunning that as well.
Okay, well, that's important. I did not understand what you were saying.
Yep.
I just want, is it Jessica Nicole?
Yeah.
I want her to be involved in some respects.
Okay.
Now, Nick, Jessica Nicole, I have no idea, like, she has, like, slightly what I would think of as slightly little girl voice, just a higher-pitched voice. Mm-hmm. I have no idea what she looks like, what her age is. Like, I mean, for all I know, she could be 50. Her character sounds like she's, like, in her 20s or maybe 30 or something like that. Is that... Can Jessica Nicole do that? Is she...
Yeah, that's her. You can't always cast voice actresses and voice actors.
Yeah, and she's...
You can't always do that.
I forget exactly how old she is.
What if she's just a brain in a jar?
She is not a brain in the jar.
Are you sure? That's what a brain in the jar would tell you.
I will say this. If it's not her, it's going to seem strange to me because I'm so used to that voice.
Well, I know.
They could also do a thing where she does the narration or something.
That's possible, although you're going to have to see the character.
Yeah. I'm just saying it's hard to cast a brain in a jar.
That is Jessica Nicole.
Okay. I mean, like, she looks like she could... She could be the character in my head.
Those of you listening to the podcast, that's what the picture looks like.
Yeah,
just
she's in the Google.
Do a Google search.
But I think that the show, I actually really like it as a podcast, and I do have some concerns of just like how it would translate, but seems like it's got good people on its side. I feel like it should be half-hour episodes and not hour-long episodes. Hopefully they'll do that.
I hope it translates better than the startup podcast translated into ABC's Alex Sink.
The what?
The startup podcast got a show on...
What's startup?
Startup is a podcast.
But what's quick gist of it?
The important thing to know is don't watch Alex Zane. All right. Moving on. Rick and Morty meets D&D.
Right, this is a comic.
There's a comic book coming. It's IDW plus Oni Press have to sort of line up on this because they have the different rights. And it is by Jim Zub, who's been doing D&D comics, and Patrick Rothfuss, who's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. Big fantasy writer, what, Name of the Wind or something?
Yeah.
That's his
yeah.
big series.
And also does, I think he does some D&D podcast stuff. He's been on...
He's a gamer.
He's a gamer. He's been on some D&D podcasts and stuff. Oh, no, he's... Acquisitions Incorporated, the Penny Arcade thing.
Was he in that?
He was on that somewhere. And the artist is Troy Little, who's a guy I've known for a long time. He just did something called... He just did an adaptation of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Okay.
But it's coming out in August. It's going to be a miniseries, and it's going to be Rick and Morty meets D&D.
Yep.
I think this is going to be super fun.
I do not watch the Rick and Morty, which means I am ostracized by my peers and the youth who throw rocks at me and Szechuan sauce.
Yep.
And then they get kicked out.
Yep.
But but anyway, I've seen funny clips though, and I'm somewhat impressed. Also, just like that. D&D's profile continues to rise, yep. even through venues as disparate as Rick and Morty.
Yeah.
I have had so many teenage kids buying D&D lately. It's crazy. It's almost weird. It's almost like a cult. Hope they're not going down to the sewers and dying. I think some irreverence directed towards it, though, is certainly going to be fun.
Yep. And then finally, Joel Jones is going to be writing and drawing an ongoing Catwoman series for DC.
I missed that one.
It was interesting. So, she does, of course, Lady Killer, which is super popular. And I
hopefully
think
this doesn't
character.
Affect that.
I wonder, what is there a focus to it that we know yet?
I don't think so. It's just sort of a bleeding cool story. So.
Cool.
All right, that's all the news. We'll be back in just a second to talk comics for the week.
One familiar cry. Rogue Cast.
We are talking comics for the week of Wednesday, April 11th. And Nick, why don't you start this off for us?
Cool. Let's talk about Domino.
I don't know anything about Domino. Who is Domino? Because I didn't read comics in the 90s.
She's Nina Thurman, she has luck-altering abilities that she can't control.
And I hope everything is better than her secret code name. I guess I do know this character primarily in the X-Men. Showed up in X-Men books as a mercenary.
X-Force.
Showed up in New Mutants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same era as Deadpool.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
Same
she was,
issue, I think.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah.
She was Cable sort of number two.
Sometimes romantic interest.
Mysterious mercenary. She's got a cool look that's sort of like a white skin, black eye patch. She's getting featured in the new Deadpool 2, which is why there's an ongoing series.
But this one is written by Gail Simone.
Yep.
Art by David Baldeon.
Yep.
Right off the bat, I'll say that David Baldeon does a really good job with the book.
I had in my head he was an artist I didn't like, but I really liked his art.
Yeah, he handles everything pretty well. From the opening page where it has a little pug puppy, which is... just cute and fun.
I have to remember to show that to Fathery since he got a pug recently. Yeah. There's not too often. I mean, dogs show up in comics all the time. Not too often you get an ugly little pug like that, though.
Pugs are at least three comics I can think of.
But then...
Name them.
Battle Pug.
Yep.
Domino.
Okay.
And
Give me a third, Randy.
Give me a third one.
All right, just make up something.
Men in Black.
Aquaman.
And Aquaman.
There was just a drowned pug. He swam by.
Okay. Oh, that was cute.
This is Gail Simone getting to have fun in the Marvel Universe, because she's not only giving us a very fun entry-level comic for Domino, but she's also... This is Domino's birthday, and... A lot of her friends are throwing her a surprise party.
Gail has not been at Marvel for a while.
Written Agent X,
her first comic her first big comic was Deadpool and Agent X.
Yeah.
And this is a big return for her, and she's bringing in one of her supporting cast from Agent X.
Yeah, which, Outlaw, which is amazing.
And she also
is Outlaw just another sort of bounty hunter type person?
Yeah, she's a bounty hunter.
Okay.
She's kind of, reminds me kind of the way that Gail wrote Lady Blackhawk, sort of a good old Southern girl.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
And then she also used one of my favorite characters who I did not expect to see, but is such a great. So it's like there's three women who are like mercenaries, friends.
Yeah.
And as a concept, it's a great pitch for a book.
It reminds me a little of like Heroes for Hire, kind of that.
It's got a little Deadpool in it, to be honest.
And Deadpool's actually even in it.
Yeah. But I mean...
That's what sold Randy on it.
Yes.
It's got a little bit of that sort of fun mercenary activity kind of thing.
And that's what I was sort of hoping for when I heard that Gail Simone was going to come back and do a Domino book. I was hoping for sort of that. And it sort of exceeded my expectations.
Oh, me too.
It was kind of exactly what I needed. It was funny, action-packed, and made me laugh.
It's got stuff for her origin, which we've not really seen. So they're starting to sort of give her origin, which is interesting, and maybe delve a little bit more into the character, give her more than... She's always been kind of either the mysterious femme fatale or kind of the fun one who gets people into trouble. Gail's giving me a little depth, and I think it really works.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't want to give anything else away because it's fun just to go in just with Domino. I mean, and just have some fun with it. I just don't want to spoil
it. Well, I think the thing is, a lot of people are going to say, I don't need a Domino book, which is an understandable thing.
Yeah.
You need this Domino book. It would have been my pick as well. Nick nabbed it first, but it's really, really good. It's probably one of the better first issues I've read in a while.
I feel like Gail on Facebook and her various other, you know, probably Twitter and stuff like that, has been doing a pretty good job hyping this up. So I hope it does well for her.
Yep. She's kind of, I mean, right now she's writing some great books. I mean, she's kind of reached a peak.
She's got
her
Vertigo thing.
Yeah, I mean, Crosswind is amazing, and I can't wait for that to come back.
Yeah. But for all that we all know her, I don't think she's like, a lot of people don't know Gail's name. Crosswind doesn't sell that well.
No.
Clean Room is a moderate hit.
Leaving Michaelopolis wasn't that big of a hit.
Yeah, the thing is, like,
in some ways, she's actually always been a little bit below the radar, but I'm going to say people who know, if you know industry names at all, like if you kind of pay attention to a little bit to creators, you probably know her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think this is one of her stronger books. This reminds me of her early stuff on Deadpool that I really, really liked. So I would definitely recommend it. Dave?
I'm going to go with a book from Aftershock this week as my pick. Brothers Dracul.
The Drac Bros.
That is, yes. The Dracula Brothers would be the full title, but when you said Dracul, it sounds old world and cool.
Yep.
And that is, in fact, appropriate because it, in fact, takes place in the year 1462. So this is like Vlad the Impaler type stuff.
Sure.
It's sort of origin story, clearly in a world that's going to have real supernatural elements. And most notably, it's sort of seen through the eyes of a brother, of his brother. And I don't know if this character, because there is a real Vlad Tepes, the guy he was based on, mm-hmm. who became Vlad the Impaler. And I don't know if he had a brother, but I do know that you're going to have like kind of large royal families in there. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if he did. On the other hand, if it's made up, who cares?
Yeah.
So it begins with him coming back. His brother has like been away from like the castle for a time, and when he arrives, there's all these spiked impaled people outside the city gates, and he's like, "What have you done, my brother?" And they go in, and you get the sense that Vlad is not quite right in the head.
Is it like a wacky sitcom where he's like, "What did you do?"
It is not even remotely like that at all. But when the two of them are talking, he's kind of talking to his brother. He's like, "How could you do that?" And then Vlad says something like, "After everything that happened, brother, how can you even ask?" And then it cuts back to 20 years earlier when they're in Gallipoli, and their father is like taken prisoner of war during a siege there. And they're kind of held when a shaky truce forms with like a sultan. They're kept as hostages, sort of, you know, think, what's his name from Game of Thrones? Who's
Theon.
The guy? Theon. Much of the story takes place once that happens there. The characters actually get fairly decently developed. They're likable and interesting, and it's clear from the beginning that Vlad is the one who's kind of doesn't want to go. The rest of they're kind of, his brother is going along with things. They're actually getting training though and being treated well what would you call Theon? He's like a well kept hostage. He's like a royal hostage.
Yeah. Royal hostage.
By the end of the issue, some secrets are beginning to emerge, and it's clear that something goes on during this youthful period for theirs that it will establish a wise lad later impale people, and will presumably lead to supernatural, perhaps vampirical stuff in the issues to come.
Indeed.
But I thought it was a cool new take on it.
The art is gorgeous.
I forgot
too.
To mention Colin Bunn, who's a prolific writer, was does another good job with this, and he's. I would not have guessed that staging, the Dracula story around two brothers using flashbacks to their youth and stuff like that would be something that would work. But it's also, it breaks from, it does not fall into any previous Dracula tradition. And I think that's why it works. So that is my pick.
All right. My pick is Champions number 19, which is the first issue of an exciting new era. It's got a big number one on it. This is Jim Zub taking over from where Mark Waid was doing the book, and Sean Isaacsi doing the art, who is a really good artist. And I really like Champions. The finale of it was one of my picks, and I was really skeptical about someone else picking it up. But actually, Zub does a great job here. He's added the Wasp and Ironheart to the mix, and does a really good job with both those characters, especially like his take on Ruby Williams, where she's got sort of a little social anxiety and kind of wants to sort of keep away from everybody else, even though she's part of the team. They have a new base, which is they build a Champions mobile bunker. So it's like a big flying ship where they live, and then they can fly around and do good. And there's a lot of sort of good character stuff, which is what I read Champions for. There's some really good interaction between Viv Vision
Who
and
is the writer
Riri,
again?
Jim Zub. And it's also got, it starts off in Canada. So I'm kind of hoping we might see
Our
Alpha
favorite
Flight.
Canadians.
We might see Alpha Flight.
Around.
But at any rate, it's a, I'm thinking he might be introducing a new hero here too. But it's got good action, got good character stuff, and is a continuation of what I liked about the Champions. So I would definitely recommend it. And then my backup pick is a comic called The Dead Hand, which is Image book by Kyle Higgins, you might know from Nightwing and Nightwing the New Order and a few other DC books. And artist by Stephen Mooney, who I don't know off the top of my head, but it's really good art. It has a little bit of that, the cover looks very Phil Noto-ish, but the interior art is, what would you say? It's more...
Well, it reminds me of Steve Epting and Mike Perkins and those other Captain America realist type artists.
Yeah.
But when I say realist, I mean like these guys are like badasses of action.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
It's like when they like draw cityscapes and stuff that these spies are maneuvering around in. Like, I haven't read this, but looking at it, it reminds me of that. There's a strong believability to it, even though this is a heightened sort of super spies.
So yeah, this is a... This is a story about a super spy from 1991, so the end of the Cold War. It opens with him finding a lost Russian science city, rescuing these two Russian scientists who had been abandoned by their people. And then it jumps forward, and we get a little flash forward to who he was, his upbringing in the 60s, and how he had this mentor and buddy who was like a Soviet agent who defected. And it all leads into the sort of modern day where he seems to have become the sheriff of this small town called Mountain View. There's a hiker who wanders into Mountain View, and that seems unusual. And there's definitely a little bit of that, Twin Pines or Wayward Pines?
Wayward Pines, yeah.
Thing where it's like everything does not seem quite...
So you got a location that has some weirdness
weird
going on.
It. And then there's a big final page that reveals the twist. And I'm very interested in seeing where this goes. It's a bit of a... Cold War, noir, action-y, and then it's got mystery stuff built into it as well.
Yeah, it's slightly heightened in that I see that the guy, like, when he's in his, like, spy infiltration mode, it's almost like a superhero costume, but, like, in the same way Black Widow's is. It's not, like, ostentatious.
No,
there's
but he
no cape or anything.
He does have, like, a mask, and his history when he was a kid is that he was obsessed with superheroes, wanted to be a superhero.
That's interesting.
So,
and in his world, it's like, there aren't superheroes, but you could become, like, a super spy.
Right. It's interesting, and I'm curious to see where it goes going from here. It was not one that was on my radar, but when I read it, I really liked the first issue. Dave, what's your backup pick?
My backup pick is the second issue of Gideon Falls, Jeff Lemire's new book. That is a I'm going to call it like a sort of horror suspense thriller based on what I know so far. Something I like about all of Jeff Lemire's books lately, or at least the main ones I'm following, like this and Royal City, and even like his Black Hammer spinoffs, is that if I sometimes forget a little bit what happened in an issue, I don't feel like I've lost anything a beat when I pick up with the next issue. He usually kind of writes a self-contained story that's going to get you caught up on everything you need to know for that issue, very quickly. And this is also a relatively straightforward story in its way, even though it has surreal and sort of supernatural elements. But there's sort of two characters who's like right now are sort of uncovering parallel mysteries that are clearly going to intersect at some point. And we were introduced to both of them in the first one. There's a guy who's seeing a psychiatrist, and a lot of the story is told between the two of them. He's the one who collects weird objects, and in his head, they belong to this supernatural place. What's it called?
Is it Gideon Falls?
No, Gideon Falls is the name of a location that's where the other guy is in. But no, there's a certain place. It's called like the something barn or the something. It reminded me of the the Black Lodge in Twin Peaks, but clearly a different concept. But
it's called the Black Barn.
The Black Barn, a strange mythical otherworldly location.
Huh.
And it's as if he's finding imagine hinges and shards of the door and pieces of that, and meaningfully it could be under a park bench.
So
and
what's the tone of this book? Is it X-Filesy?
I would say right now, yes, but not like he's like a conspiracy, not a conspiracy theorist, but he's like his psychiatrist thinks he's paranoid and suffering delusions.
Okay.
So and to we kind of have cause to believe him because they're always right in these cases,
right.
But we don't know at all what the deal is. So it's more like just kind of a weird supernatural mystery where he's not like a standard investigator I've seen so many strange mysteries Scully and Mulder. And then paralleling that, there's a priest who just arrived in the town of Gideon Falls. And he also had a strange encounter that he's being questioned about in this one, where he seems to have, he thought he saw the other night his predecessor, who everybody was being cagey and mysterious about, and they're like, but when he finally talks to somebody about him, they're like, oh right, he died 2 weeks ago. And he's like, well, who was the person I saw then? Because it was definitely him. And so he has a weird, there's actually some really strong dialogue between him, the police, who have a worry that he might have a role in something else that happened, some killings that are going on in this town. There's an interesting exchange between him and just a jail guard and stuff like that. Just good Jeff Lemire city or small town dialogue, which he seems to be good at. And I'm actually really liking the priest, whose first instinct when some of this weird stuff starts to happen is to call up the bishop who sent him there and say, oh, it's super weird. I need you to transfer me. I don't want to be in this town. Get me out of here right now. And I'm like, oh, he did the exact sensible thing that anybody would do if they saw enough weird stuff. Anyway, it is very clear that the lives of these two guys will intersect and that the Black Barn has something to do with both of these things. But there's definitely a lot of weird kind of slow burn supernatural stuff going on in this one. And I really like the tone of it. I, as we discussed in the previous issue, not a big fan of the artist Andrea Sorrentino, although I know people who are reading it because of his art and who read some of their previous collaborations because of his art.
Dave, you and I are just haters.
I am just a hater. but I will say that this issue, I think, either his storytelling was a little stronger or there were fewer sequences that I felt pushed him past his limits of sort of getting a little bit abstract with it, which he maybe did in the first one, and those sequences were a little unclear to me.
By the way, but, getting abstract with it was Will Smith's least popular song.
I liked that he celebrated Dadaist philosophy and art theory.
Big Dadaist time.
Big Dadaist style. Nick?
I'm going to keep with my Liefeldian theme and go with the Despicable Deadpool 298.
I don't know. I feel like I should have to put Nick down for saying those words.
Yep.
But here's the thing. People who are not necessarily the greatest talents in the world can sometimes come up with cool ideas, and other people have done cool stuff with his ideas.
Also, it's Nick's birthday, so I'm not going to make fun of Deadpool today.
But is it his actual birthday? Not until
that's true.
Technically true.
I'm just saying that really this is a Gail Simone week, and then whoever writes Despicable Deadpool week.
Which is Jerry Dugan. Yeah. With art by Mike Hawthorne. But honestly, it's a fun concept. Deadpool is tired of himself and wants to kill himself.
Hey, I killed Deadpool.
I know, right? So he puts a $20 million bounty on his head.
It seems inefficient, but okay.
Well, he stole the $20 million from a group of supervillains that he's now hiring to kill himself.
That actually seems very Deadpool level of efficiency.
Actually, yeah, Looney Tunes. I mean, Deadpool has the Looney Tunes thing. That's how Wile E. Coyote would kill himself, too.
So it's sort of the smorgasbord of supervillains trying to kill him. For everyone from the Juggernaut to the big ones are Taskmaster and Bullseye.
I feel like Juggernaut could kill him pretty quick.
I feel like that, too, yeah.
He actually comes up with a clever way of defeating Juggernaut, which is kind of hilarious.
But if he wants to be killed, why is he...
But he doesn't want to make it easy.
Oh, that sort of fits Deadpool, too. By the way, I have a quick question before you go on.
Yeah.
Is Despicable Deadpool, is that just basically the regular Deadpool series right now?
Yeah, it's the main
Deadpool. Okay, just double-checking. It's not like a sister book.
But I know it's getting relaunched as something else, and I'm sure Deadpool will be back to doing something else crazy when that happens. But in this one, he's trying to kill himself.
Sure.
Yep.
But not hard.
But, well, he doesn't want to make it easy. And you would think Taskmaster and Bullseye would be up for the task. And they do a pretty good job. There's some great dialogue between those three characters. Because Taskmaster and Deadpool have a lot of history together.
Yeah, true.
Bullseye and Deadpool have some history together. And I don't know. I think Jerry Duggan writes a pretty darn good Wade Wilson. And captures the insanity pretty well.
Is it a standalone issue?
No, it's sort of the final story arc. This one is all about the villains, and in the next issue, because of the bounty, the heroes get involved as well. So it's going
to
be the heroes.
That's like finally a reason to punch Deadpool in the face.
Well, last issue, or I guess a couple issues back, he and Deadpool went at it, because they have some history with... I mean, Jerry Duggan wrote a really good story with Wolverine and Captain America, and Deadpool sort of teaming up, kind of delving into Deadpool's like actual past, which was sad. Not Deadpool at all. Yeah, make fun. Sure, it's fine.
I'm not making fun of Deadpool.
Honestly, though, it was just a good issue. Lots of hilarity, made me laugh, and that's sort of what I was in the mood for. other stuff on my stack.
It's a big stack.
Yep, the final issue of Thanos, which is a throwdown versus Thanos versus Thanos.
So either way, Thanos wins.
So Jeff Lemire did the first 12, and then
Donny Cates did the last 6.
Then I have X-Men Red, the third issue of that, which has Sentinels, it has Gambit, there's cool new powers being used, and their big villain makes an appearance, which I love the villain. it's interesting to see her back in play.
This was really good. I really like X-Men Red.
And Mahmoud Ezrar is doing an amazing job. I've always liked his art, but he just keeps getting better and better.
Also, if you've ever wanted to see Gambit light up a bunch of alt-right people using their own tiki torches, that happens.
Oops. You know, I have been feeling warmly towards Gambit lately.
Yep.
I liked him in the Gambit Rogue series. I liked him in that clip I watched of the X-Men animated series that I randomly... had him saying something kind of messed up to a priest.
Sounds like you're becoming a big old Gambit fan.
I feel like I'm Rogue herself.
Yes.
Some days I love him, Sugar, and some days I can't stand him.
You're a Southern Belle, Dave.
DC launches out of the Dark Knight's Metal a book called The Immortal Men, which is written by James Tynion and Ryan Benjamin, but more importantly, it has Jim Lee doing the artwork and storytelling and stuff like that. So
those characters existed before. Was there like a version of the Immortal Men?
Yes, Dave, they're immortal.
I see what you mean. But did DC have a licensed group of characters called the Immortal Men?
They had an Immortal Man.
Yeah.
Okay, but this is clearly just kind of really taking like the name.
I think they're making
name.
Out that the Immortal Man was a part of the society that the Immortal Men are. So he comes from them.
Right. By the way. If you take out the T, they're the Immortal Men, and that's a different book.
That is a different book. That's like a Mark Miller book.
Yes.
But I will say, for those people who like Dark Knight's Metal, one of the main protagonists from that book is the main protagonist here, which is the Batman Who Laughs. He's the main villain.
Oh, you said protagonist.
Well, antagonist. I meant antagonist, not protagonist.
Like, clearly, I wouldn't read Dark Knight's Metal, but some things happened.
So, if that... is interesting to you, then you should continue. X-Men Blue number 25 sees a new team put together. It's like my favorite 90s version of the X-Men all over again that Colin Bunn is writing here.
It's the Bunninator?
It is the Bunninator. You're using...
I kind of wanted to... Yeah, I was happy to see whether it's ongoing or not. The X-Babies, the youthful X-Men team...
They got kicked into space.
Kicked to the curb, and yeah, who do we got?
There's Polaris, there's Daken, there's Jimmy Hudson from the Ultimate Universe, there's...
That's Kid Wolverine to you and me.
Yeah, you know, there's Zorn, because, you know, you need Zorn.
It's a weird team.
And, it is a weird team. Why can I never remember... It's not Bloodscream, it's Blood...
Bloodstorm?
Bloodstorm, yeah. It's Aurora Monroe from the Vampire Universe.
That is a weird lineup. I'm curious to know if that'll stick.
Colin Bunn wrote a lot of comics in the 90s.
Yeah. And he's utilizing all of his X-Men knowledge in this, doing some crazy things, but I like it.
We are at a point where 90s nostalgia is hitting, so...
Sure. True. Sure, we gotta be coming up on 2000s nostalgia.
Oh, God.
It's time, for the people who... The first X-Men that they read was Grant Morrison's... Yeah. Or worse yet, Chuck Austin.
Oh.
Like, when are we going to finally see the She-Hulk and Juggernaut back together as a couple
again?
When
are we going to see Stacey X again?
Yeah, the super prostitute.
moving on. Detective Comics 978, which sees the colony, Kate Kane's father's military group return to wreak havoc upon Batman and his friends.
Those guys have been the thorn in the side from the beginning of the book.
However, now that they've recruited Batwoman, Azrael, and Batwing, so...
Wait, Batwoman was with the group from the beginning, right?
Well, no, the colony has. They're working for the colony now.
Well, that's going to be more difficult for
the guys. Yeah, it's a little bit more difficult.
More difficult.
Old Man Logan, number 38, sees Old Man Logan taking on Wilson Fisk, which I'm sure that's going to go well for all involved.
Not Wilson Phillips.
No, not Wilson Phillips.
Listen, Randy, she's a big girl, but...
And I didn't get a chance to read it, but the third issue of Sideways hits, which I've actually really enjoyed the first two issues.
Remember the crazy thing we found out where, like, Grant Morrison is going to be, like, a creative consultant on some issues down the line?
I think with, like, issue 5 or 6, he's coming on to help Dentity, pen it. It's crazy.
You know, he was the co-creator of, like, the Atom that Gale wrote for a little while. I think he occasionally is, like, sort of advising, you know, guy to the DC universe, and it sounds like he just landed on one of the newer books.
Do you think it's basically like Grant Morrison just calls, and he's like, hey, I've got an idea.
What if this guy could go sideways into space? Yeah, I think it is.
All right. So, on my list, Exiles number 1, which is a kind of a cool team of, like, Valkyrie and Blink and Kamala Khan from the future.
But alternate universe versions,
yep,
like...
That gets started this week. Ninjak number 6, which is the start of a new story arc, and it ties into some Ninjak Valiant history, but as always, it's pretty approachable, and I really liked it. It's got some good action. Christos Cage doing the best version of that book so far. Damnation continues. It almost concludes with Doctor Strange number 388 and Scarlet Spider number 17. Captain America number 700 is a big giant issue that wraps up Wade's sort of futuristic story where Cap is forced to become sort of the president of this post-apocalyptic America. And
as you might guess, Cap is not a guy who's like, yes, I want to be the absolute ruler of anybody.
Things don't go particularly well. There's a big battle against the resistance. It wraps up pretty well and sort of tells the story that Wade's been telling us since the beginning. And then there's also a backup that has a lost Kirby story that Wade is, like, dialoguing.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of cool.
And
he fights Batroc.
Batroc.
Yeah.
So that's notable. To us, at least.
Kirby drawing Batroc is actually a very cool thing.
Yes, it is.
And then Star Wars Thrawn number 3 introduces a female lieutenant, or actually a character who's sort of an assistant within the corporate world and sort of goes through her story. He's definitely building up Thrawn's... allies and stuff in these stories, and it's all about sort of betrayal and machinations in the Star Wars universe, and it's been pretty good so far. Dave, what else is on your list?
Let's see. Did one of y'all mention Oblivion Song issue 2?
Did not.
So yeah, Robert Kirkman's sellout first issue of Oblivion Song has its second issue. Let's see, real quick, the premise was like this. It was an alternate world?
No, alien world basically gets teleported into a major metropolitan city.
But not like the whole world.
like a part of their world.
Right. It
takes
like
over a part of... Basically, a space from a city gets taken over by a part of an alien
and
world.
You've got, like, sort of lots of subplots and subplots, but revolving around a guy who makes these... crosses the barrier into it to try and retrieve people, and there's some cool mysteries and stuff percolating in there, and some stunning artwork. I think anybody who's liked Kirkman's other stuff, whether it's Walking Dead or Outcast or Invincible, he rarely launches a new book, and so this is still a great opportunity to get on board.
Well, he finished Invincible, so he needed something else.
It's true. And I believe we did just the other week get back in new printings of Oblivion Song number 1.
We've had the first printing the whole time.
Have we?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, and we have more of the first printing coming this week.
They've been selling out of so many things, it's hard to keep track.
Oblivion Song, they heavily overprinted. We actually got a bunch of first printing. We had it up until this week. Just sold out. We should have some more coming in this week.
So we are sold out, though.
but it's not a new printing. That's important.
Yeah. Let's see. There's a new RoboCop series from Brian Wood. I read this issue, and I actually had somewhat mixed feelings because it is weirdly like light on action, but it does do an interesting job of taking, I think, sort of real time for when it took place, RoboCop, and imagining 20 years have passed since then, and there's all sorts of interesting things that have happened since then, all the satire and somewhat depressing world spiraling under the weight of... sort of corrupt corporate ventures and stuff like that is very much still in effect.
Let me ask a question. Does Brian Wood use any of Frank Miller's ideas from RoboCop 2?
I believe, in a blessed way, he does not. there's actually an interesting read. I really do wish there was some more action with RoboCop, but there is a reason why there is not, and he, of course, is in it. But there's, like... people do have, like... crowdsourced policing, like they have on their phones, they're supposed to like film anything they think might be a crime, and then if it is, they get entered into like this lottery where they can win prizes. So there's this weird, like, you know, ridiculousness of some of the RoboCop's ideas, but some of the stuff that feels almost too real, like there was good stuff in it. I'm gonna definitely be checking it out. And lastly, did we mention the Crude yet? From a new comic from Image called Crude. I didn't actually get a chance to read it, but I like the premise. It's about a former Russian hitman who he's like retired, but like kind of comes out of the game. Then what sounds like a cliched premise, where his son gets killed, and he's out to find out who did it and get righteous payback. But unlike John Wick, it seems like this is sort of more the story of him finding out as he tracks down the people, the killers. Also finding out more about his son, who he maybe like didn't know very well, and kind of finding out his secrets and what his life was like. And so there's like a personal element to it too, between the violent happenings. The Crude in it refers to crude oil because it takes place in this kind of like gritty Russian refinery town, which is a cool setting. Anyway, so I'm sure to check that one out and figure some people might want to check it.
All right, cool. That wraps up for comics for us this week. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about some TV and movies and, of all things, a book.
Talking about comics, movies, and fame. They even talk about board games. No week is the same.
All right, we wanted to check in on a few things. Some TV shows that Nick and I have watched. Nick, you mentioned we watched Killing Eve on BBC America.
Yeah, I didn't know much about this other than... my wife told me that Sandra Oh was in it, and I like Sandra Oh, so I was like, okay, I'll give it a shot. I was more than pleasantly surprised with this one, which is a show about two different characters, one who's a MI5, like, is she an analyst?
She's like assistant to somebody.
Jack Ryan position?
Well, it's even less than a Jack Ryan position. Like
she's in meetings, but she seems to be very low level.
Yeah.
Okay.
But she's...
Is there kind of like borderline secretary or...
Yeah, but she's definitely a little higher than that.
Yeah.
So.
It's an odd position, but she's also obsessed with becoming like a spy. And the counterpoint to this is a new Russian assassin,
French.
She kills a Russian.
Yeah, she kills a Russian. We see her in Vienna and in Italy.
Yes, in Italy. But she is this French assassin who's sort of reveling in the job and reveling in the money that that job gives her.
Is this realistic in any way? Or is
yes.
It
yes, very realistic. Very realistic.
That's weird, because that sort of sounded like it could be a larger-than-life premise.
What's interesting is there is that there's not a lot of female assassins.
No.
Like, Sandra Oh she's convinced that the assassin was a female, and her boss is like, no, it wasn't. And she does research, and I guess they mentioned, like, there's, like, three.
Yeah.
One of whom is still operating, it's not her.
And then two are dead.
And so it's sort of a big deal of this. I mean, in the movies and stuff, we see femme fatales all the time.
Right.
But this is supposed to be a little more real world where there's not that many female assassins. So hashtag feminism.
Yep.
But the focus is, it's very much a dual show. It's about Sandra Oh's character and sort of her fascination with this. But at the same time, there's this very focus on this woman who's sort of dead inside and very much a sociopath, and why she does the way she does, and these horrific killings that she does.
It's beautifully shot. It's sort of along the kind of Hannibal lines where the gore is beautiful.
What's the network?
BBC.
BBC America.
Okay.
Which is, they've done that kind of thing before. But, sure.
I don't know where you're watching it. AMC is also airing it. So I watched it on the AMC app because it's free on the ABC AMC app.
I watched it. I recorded it off of BBC America.
So did you see the ads? Because they show the ads for the season. There's like a 90-second ad for Killing Eve.
Oh, I didn't. I saw the preview for the... Or basically showed like a 10 or 20-second thing, like a scene from next episode.
Because they sort of give away, I think, what the premise of the show is in a way that doesn't give it away in the first episode.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
I feel like there's going to be a little more direct cat and mouse between... Eve and the assassin.
Well, I feel like there has to be because of a scene in it where they actually run into each other.
Yeah.
I feel like that has to be a pretty big notable thing.
But Sandra has a huge star turn here.
Yeah.
There's also some funny bits, like when she brings in her husband's Polish, and she brings in his, like, nephew to translate Polish, so it's from like the...
Well, like Polish slang.
Like Polish slang and stuff, and it's really funny.
It reminds me a little bit. It's got elements of Greg Rucka's Queen of Country stuff.
It's very compelling.
Yeah,
it's very interesting.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it.
It also reminded me a little bit of Barry, which is HBO's new show that is about. It's one of the Saturday Night guys, Bill Hader.
Yeah, Bill Hader.
He's writing and he's co-writing with Alec Berg, one of the big Seinfeld guys and Silicon Valley guy, and it's basically about this hitman who comes to L.A. and is on a hit, he meets this actor and gets involved in an acting class run by Henry Winkler, who is this sort of star. This guy is a little bit full of himself.
So Henry Winkler?
It's got a little Get Shorty plus Gross Point Blank to it.
Okay.
So it's like, he's this hitman. He was a military guy. He's got that sort of... doesn't know what he's doing. He's very sort of hollowed out, and acting is sort of this thing that's sort of bringing him to life. And so we're seeing this thing of, like, he's finally starting to find this thing that's for him, but he's also having to keep doing these assassinations for the Chechens. It's funny. It's weird. It's got a little bit of heart to it, and I found it interesting because it reminds me of Gross Point Blank and the assassin Killing Eve, where we're sort of showing what it takes to be an assassin, what kind of personality you have, and I think that's interesting.
Well, you've sold me on the Gross Point Blank Get Shorty comparison, because
it
those
really
two are my favorite, some of my favorite things.
I think you would really like Barry. I'm really
digging
it.
And I like Bill Hader. Is this a half hour?
Half hour? Yeah.
Oh, nice.
It's paired with Silicon Valley right now.
Oh, very cool.
So definitely worth a watch. And then, Dave, you saw a movie that I know Nick and I both want to see.
Yep, so I'll be as spoiler-free as possible, but while the iron is hot... Is that what the phrase is?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it is.
The movie A Quiet Place,
yep.
Is that right? People, you know, if you've seen the trailers, you're probably going to remember them. This is a sort of horror suspense movie with definitely a mysterious element that I will try to avoid. But what is clear even from the trailers is that there's a family kind of living in an isolated area who has been living in sort of silence for a time. To the point where they are practiced at it. They literally can't speak for fear of something that is in the nearby forest. And so they have, like, you know, they communicate through sign language. They walk with a sort of tentative quietness that you would if you knew a killer was nearby and you don't want to crunch a leaf. When they play games, like, in their kind of cabin, they're playing, like, Monopoly, but with, like, all these kind of, like... soft pieces or whatever, nothing that makes any
and
sort of sound.
They're playing on like blankets and stuff like that.
Right, right.
They're really sort of deafen every sound.
Everything is, the sound is clearly meant to be muffled. And there's, let's see, playing the female lead is Emily Blunt, and the male lead is...
John Krasinski.
What's his name?
John Krasinski.
Krasinski, okay, yeah.
He actually directed it as well.
Yeah. Right, which I did not know, and here's a funny story. So this is, what's his name, Jim from The Office?
Yep.
I never watched The American Office, I only watched the British version. I know of, you know, Jim from The Office, but not much beyond that. Right before it started, a guy I saw with our former co-worker, Chris Jones...
Mm-hmm.
Was talking about, oh, you know, we were kind of doing the Get Out comparison, you know, there's like comedians, you know, TV comedians doing movies, and he's like, oh yeah, he directs and stars or whatever, and I kind of just loosely followed that in the back of my head. I'm like about half an hour into the movie watching this bearded lead guy, who I'm like, this guy's pretty good. I'm like, that's Jim from The Office. did not even really kind of see it. I'm sure followers of The Office will...
Well,
see it.
Given how meme-worthy Jim's various faces were in The Office, it's no surprise that he'd have sort of silent acting chops.
Right, that's kind of true. Somebody told me also that he was like one of the final candidates for Captain America.
He was.
And weirdly, because he's kind of got the somewhat grave look in this, and he's got the beard and stuff, and he looks like how Cap does in the new trailers for Infinity War. Anyway... there's really not too much more I'm going to say about it other than it. It is a... I quite liked it. I had a few issues with it. It's extremely intense, and it does... there's even articles about this. It's a very quiet movie, which is to say, if you're in there crunching your popcorn loudly, or if you're at the Alamo Draft House or Flicks or whatever, getting your loud-ass food like I was, you're going to like suddenly like feel very like louder, and like all eyes are on you in the theater, or ears are on you when you're eating.
Order only soft foods and do not slurp your drink.
That's right. That said, the movie has music and other things that so that it's not a completely silent experience. There are points where the characters speak in sort of for various reasons for in sort of normal voices. So and then that's when you quick eat your sandwich is during those moments. Now anyway, it's a good intense movie. There's a deaf actress who plays their daughter in it, and she is honestly as good as the adults are. The like, you know sort of Emily Blunt is always good. I'm sorry, what's the
John
name of the
Krasinski?
Krasinski. He's good in the, I don't know if he has done dramatic roles before this, but he's very good.
He's done a few.
But I feel like this girl, whose name I have no idea what it is like the standout. She's probably like, I don't know, 11 or something like that. What was that?
I just like the idea that she's 11.
Oh, I was like, it's not funny.
It's kind of funny if she's 11.
Oh, it's interesting because, you know, kid actors can be dodgy.
Yeah.
And I assume there's also a difficulty in, you know, the I don't know a ton of deaf actors. Was it Marley Matlin is one of them, and she is like, she's amazing.
She is.
She has been for a while, and I have a feeling that this girl has it within her potentially to reach those kind of heights because she gives a very emotive performance, and I was very impressed with it.
Interesting. I thought I'd seen about this. John Krasinski pushed to cast the deaf actress in The Quiet Place.
Yeah.
And I was looking to see the name.
I believe they did a lot
Millicent Simmons is her name.
That's a very British-sounding name. Is she British?
She might be.
I believe they did a lot of like sign language while filming. They tried to really capture that.
Well, it looks like... I think I remember reading some snippet of an interview where I think everybody learned it for the sake of the movie. And so she was kind of in a place where, like, I think she was saying, like, this was really pretty an amazing experience where everybody around me knew sign language. That is not the normal experience in the world.
Sure.
But anyway, the movie does make you think about things you wouldn't. It's scary in ways you wouldn't normally think of. It has some cool kind of mysteries and stuff going on. So there's a lot to it, but it's also in many ways a very straightforward suspense thing in a Hitchcockian kind of...
So Millicent Simmons is 14 years old.
Oh, okay.
That's why I thought you were exaggerating. I thought she was like a teenager in this. I guess she plays younger.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, they don't, it's not like characters name their ages, and I can't tell, I don't have kids, I don't know how old kids are.
World of Warcraft style ages don't appear above
them. Yeah, and this was like filmed like a year ago, so she was five when she made it.
That's how time
I'm also bad with math. No, but yeah, no, I feel like she's going to be kind of a standout, and I hope to see her in more stuff after this.
Oh, cool. I'm excited. I'm going to see this tomorrow, so.
I'm going to see this at some point. I do want to see it. Nick, you also saw a big movie. You saw Ready Player One?
I did, and it was exactly what I wanted, and I know that is interesting because most people either love this movie or hate this movie, as they love or hate the book that it's based off of.
And I've seen some who liked the book, did not like the movie, and vice versa.
Yeah.
Yep. Something like some people who are like, you know, where it fails is a book. It's great as spectacle on the screen, or it let out everything from the book. It blew it.
Yep.
Right. And there's not a lot of depth to this movie. It's about a kid in the future who loves all things pop culture and lives in a society that kind of revels in pop culture and lives in an online world.
You know, I listened to the Thug Notes, which anybody who hasn't listened to Thug Notes cover a book before needs to check that out. It's awesome. I listened to the Thug Notes for Ready Player One. And although it has a reputation as not being a, you know, deep story and kind of playing on a lot of nostalgia, just hearing him do the raw plot, I was like, but there's a story to this. There are characters and character development and all that stuff.
I mean,
stuff.
It's also about corporate greed and...
Right.
It's got an arc.
Yeah, it has an arc.
Right, maybe just a little familiar tropes.
It's just not super sophisticated.
And correct. Yeah, people are maybe a little bit more there for the fun, sometimes for the fun nostalgia.
And I went in for the sort of fun popcorn nature of the film, getting to see all these...
Spielberg hasn't done one of those in a while. He's done his Munich and Lincoln and his serious-ass movies.
And The Post, and and I think this was feeling like, okay, I'm going to have some fun, I'm going to stretch my legs, and we're going
to... And at the same time, in a way, he's also kind of tipping the hat to himself, because, man, he was 80s pop culture all over the place.
Yeah, he's not the guy to do this.
Yeah, but there's references to everything from Star Wars to Back to the Future to Overwatch to Halo.
Any particularly weird one that you can say with it that isn't too big a spoiler? Like, wow, I can't believe they mentioned Burger Time, the video game, or something like that.
No, I mean a lot of Atari games, but I expected that because of the book.
Yar's Revenge.
but there was nothing that I was like super shocked with. I mean, I love seeing Iron Giant. I mean, that's really cool.
And Iron Giant, I don't think is in the book.
He's not.
Right. I believe he loosely replaces Inframan.
Yeah, that's right.
Giant.
Yeah.
Well, and that's sort of the nature of, because Ready Player One, the book, was all about 80s nostalgia.
Yeah.
And this one definitely kind of encroaches upon till now, because if you have Overwatch, you have now.
Yeah.
So it's going weirdly through 2018, which is kind of bizarre, but stops there.
Yeah.
And this takes place in like 2030. But, you know.
I also just realized I also saw a movie in the theaters.
Mm-hmm.
It was Pacific Rim Uprising.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Which I wound up liking. I think go in with your expectations low. It is definitely not as good as the first one.
Right.
But it has the same sort of cheesy fun that I liked in the first one. It's got some good twists and turns.
John Boyega good?
John Boyega's pretty good. It's a weird cast of like teenage cadets, which is maybe a weird call, but I think they challenged it all right with them.
Is one of them the girl from The Quiet Place?
It might be. She's like 11.
Just checking, yeah. She's good. She's particularly good for her age, so they advanced her.
I mean, Charlie Day shows back up, right?
Charlie Day is a big part of it. As another scientist. There's some cool stuff with the Jaegers. There's some cool stuff with Kaiju. There's a reason why the Kaiju come back. It's fun. And there's a promise of a third movie, which I don't know. I don't think this did very well, so I don't know how likely that is. But I kind of want to see the third one if they do it.
Yeah. Well, a sequel is unlikely, and that happens, so...
Yep. So maybe 5 more years or 10 more years or whatever it is, we'll get Pacific Rim 3.
The Pacific Rim nostalgia will come about.
Yes.
People like, remember back when robots punched monsters? Now we just live in a barren wasteland.
Pepperidge Farm remembers. all right, and finally, you guys want to talk about Final Girls.
Right. Yeah. It's a novel that a friend put me onto, and I liked, and then Nick tried it out, and I believe you liked it as well?
I did, very much so, and I forgot to look... I remember the author's name. It's like Riley...
Sounds right so far.
That's bad. We have to at least say the author's name.
While you're looking that up, I will say that this is based on the trope that people know about from horror movies of the final girl who's like in Friday the 13th or Halloween or all those slasher movies, Nightmare on Elm Street. The person who's the last girl standing and generally comes out alive.
But this is sort of a more real-world nature of that, where it's like...
It's more like there's a kind of a strange bond that forms between three women who all play various roles in it. One of them is the central character.
Yeah.
Who all survived experiences that are reminiscent of this, like a person who went crazy at a campground and killed, or like at a cabin.
Yeah.
And killed like everybody there but this one girl. And there's mysterious things about some of these ones. Another one was like a sorority killing, right?
Yeah.
And so they reflect those things, and it's like, you know, the newspapers are like, oh, it's like the final girls, that's what we're going to call them.
Right.
And they were like on news and media. And our lead character has kind of tried to rebuild her life and just, in some ways, forget about it. She runs a very prosaic sort of upper middle class life.
Yeah, because of like the fallout and sort of the money that she's gotten from right. various, you know,
she's got like a fancy apartment in New York.
It's New York,
and she runs like a cooking blog thing that's kind of cutesy-ish cooking thing.
Her boyfriend is.
It's like the exact opposite of the horror she went through,
right?
And by the way, the quote on the cover of this is, or at least the one I read, was from Stephen King saying, like, mm-hmm. if you liked Gone Girl, you'll like this. And it does have some of those elements of introspective qualities about, like, I think there's, like, gender relations, but also sort of PTSD. I don't think you necessarily need to have undergone near killing by a serial killer to recognize, you know, kind of her trying to get through this. But the past comes back to haunt her in a way.
Yeah.
You want to say, like, kind of what the catalyst is? What sort of brings it back into her life? I think we could say the basics.
I'm kind of blanking.
Well, another one of the final girls who's been missing
right.
for years, kind of out of the picture, shows up at her doorstep. And she's very much not like her. She is kind of like punk, almost like punk rock chick, who's kind of survived by getting hard to the world.
Well, that's not the real catalyst. The real catalyst is one of the final girls gets killed, or
right.
dies.
And then this other girl kind of enters into her orbit. And
but it is very much a character piece about this one person sort of trying to overcome her past and mm-hmm. sort of the psychological ramifications that have occurred because mm-hmm. of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of getting in her headspace, and I thought that writing was pretty strong.
Yeah, the writer's name is Riley Sager.
Sager,
and I feel like he or she has written another book, and I'll probably check it out because I thought this one was very well written.
Mm-hmm.
It
does have a strong, you know, for all that it gets in her head, there's a strong mystery to it, too.
Yeah. And there are twists and
exactly
turns.
What's going on is in there, and that's where I think it also I see the Gone Girl comparison in that too.
Yeah,
you know, you kind of think it's about one thing, and it's about you know, it maybe veers off in another direction. And there were several times when I was reading this where I was like, I really don't know what's going to quite happen next. I have some thoughts on it, but I'm like, there's a certain thing that happens in the park. You know what I'm talking about, Nick? And I was like, whoa, that's a game changer. That's strange and unusual. And, like, where's the book going to go from there? And it's interesting to see the characters pushed to some sort of extreme places.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, definitely the writer's dealing with tropes. I mean, you can't not when you're writing about something like
right.
this. But he definitely has its own voice to put to it and
mm-hmm.
does things that are I wasn't seeing. So I like that. I think that kind of breathes new fresh air into it.
Yep.
I
found it pretty page-turnery, too,
much
though.
So,
like, you can kind of breeze through this one pretty quickly. You know,
if you're trapped in the back of a car, you can read it in 7 hours.
Yeah, yeah. Nick is the living proof.
I am.
So, yeah, Final Girls, people ought to check that out.
Yes.
All right. That'll wrap it up for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Don't forget our midnight release next week. Oh, I almost forgot. We have a game demo this weekend. There's a game, Wanted Dead. It's like a gunfighter game. It's going on Saturday. You can find all the details for that on our Facebook and on our website. Make sure and come out for that. And until that time,
Yo Joe!
Procast.
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating and review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.